Years ago, I was drunk in the DeSoto Hotel, the old DeSoto Hotel in Savannah, Georgia. When some men from AA came to get me, and I made the comment in my introductory talk when I reached the General Service Conference in New York, that two men from the Savannah group of Alcoholics Anonymous came down and made a 12-step call on the future delegate of the state of Georgia. That is from whence we all come. Your speaker tonight, I met 13 years ago at a Tennessee state convention in Gatlinburg, Tennessee. Joe and I and my wife Margaret, Father Charles Hamling, who has since passed away, and Maurice Riley and his wife spent considerable time together at that convention, up on top of Klingman's Dome and over to Cherokee. Six of us in an automobile talking about Alcoholics Anonymous. This speaker that I met 13 years ago came into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. He came into the program with an intensity and with a very devoted sponsor, a man from his hometown in Tennessee. Little did he or any of us know that day in Tennessee that we was riding over the mountain with a future Southeastern Regional Trustee. And yet he's here with us tonight, a fine representative of our region in New York. So I give you our present Southeastern Regional Trustee, Joe Kropp.
I'm an alcoholic and my name is Joe Kraus. What Virgil failed to tell you in that little synopsis was the fact that we were so busy talking, or they were so busy talking with me and telling me about what I had gotten into, Bob, that we failed to notice that our gas tank was running out. And on top of Klingman's Dome, I looked down and I said, it's sitting on empty. What in the hell will I do? Well, you know, our higher power was with us that day because the gravity, I suppose, and going downhill got us back to Gatlinburg. And when we pulled into the station there on the edge of Gatlinburg, it took 23 1/2 gallons of gas. So I think my higher power was with all of us that day. I want to thank you all for inviting me to your assembly meeting. I've been to most of the states or areas in the Southeast. I'm holding Bermuda and the Bahamas and the Virgin Islands and Puerto Rico for next year. And I'll have to tell you, this is the largest state assembly I have ever seen. Now, I have always known that Georgia was a great state. I'm serious about that. And I've been told by those of you who I know in Georgia about AA in Georgia. In fact, John hardly let me forget it last April. But it's a living and true thing. I was fortunate in being able to attend some of your business sessions today, and I thoroughly enjoyed it. And I want to commend you and compliment you on the way you're conducting your business and the way AA is growing in the state of Georgia. It's a far cry from what I remember a few years back coming into the program. You know, I never thought I was intended to be an alcoholic. I remember as a little boy in the small town I grew up in and still live in, that the two or three men who had fallen from grace, so to speak, were mostly treated with respect, but they were shunned. I never will forget one gentleman who at one time had been the largest lumber merchant in Tennessee. And when he would cut past by our home, he would tip his hat very graciously to my mother, and he called her Miss Maddie, and he would say good morning or good afternoon, Miss Maddie. But I was always told that leave Mr. Ed alone, he might be in his cups. So I suppose that was my first contact with anyone who had a drinking problem. As far as I know, no one in my family, except for me, has had a drinking problem. And why I'm an alcoholic, I don't know. But once I found out I was an alcoholic, and it was explained to me what being an alcoholic was, and what could be done by following the program of AA, I stopped resenting the fact that I was an alcoholic. Because when it was pointed out that we had the best cure ratio of any illness if we would follow the 12 steps of AA, it made it much easier for me to accept it. I'm the only son of a German Catholic family in a small town called Lawrenceburg, Tennessee. It's located halfway between Memphis and Chattanooga and 70 miles south of Nashville. I had three sisters all older than I. In fact, my youngest sister was 13 years older when I was 13 years of age when I was born. So I'm sure I was a spoiled brat. And I'm sure that I know now that it, for a while I had four mothers. Two of my sisters are still living, and they're in their late 70s, and my mother and younger sister have passed away, so now I only have two mothers. But believe me, I still have two mothers. And tonight, when I call home, they will be just as interested as they were 13 years ago when I came to AA. There was really no reason that I know of for me to drink. And for many years, I did not. I had a very normal childhood for a small town. I had no problem with school. I participated in the normal activities of any youngster. I was not denied anything. I grew up in the Depression years when very few people had anything, so we were all in the same boat, so if we had something, we shared it. And through grade school and high school, I don't ever remember taking a drink. Now, I know that there was alcohol in our home because I helped make wine, but as far as drinking, I don't know. I was a mediocre student all the way through school. I received an appointment to the Maritime Academy and graduated from there. And I'm sure that I had had some drinks or some beer along the way, wine, but I never can remember, like so many people can, when they had their first drink, when they had that first feeling of, or the glow that comes with it, that I eventually developed. The first time that I ever remember being intoxicated, I'd been sent to the West Coast as a midshipman and assigned to sea duty. And there were six midshipmen in this group. We'd been assigned to a vessel. And that was my first drunk that I know of. Because we went aboard ship, we found our quarters, we were given a 48-hour pass, and the next thing I remember was being hauled into my bunk and said, gee, you should never drink anything. Now, I really don't remember what happened. So I not only had gotten drunk, I had my first blackout, which I didn't know that I'd had. The only other time that I remember being intoxicated while in service was in a little South American country, and I drank too much beer, and that one made me sick. I remember that quite well. I was in a little town called Buenaventura in the country of Colombia. But outside of those two times, during the time I was in service, I never remember getting drunk. I would have some drinks. And I've been told later that I had started into a period of controlled drinking, not knowing what controlled drinking was. After the war was over, I stayed in the reserve. And by the way, I took my 20-year retirement through the reserve and active duty. But I went back to my hometown and went into business that my grandfather had started and that my father was running and that I thought I would run. But I didn't like the automobile business. And I thought I could do great things by going into the insurance business. So I not only started a small agency, but a major insurance company. I must have really been a conniver back at that time, because I was picked up by this company and was made a regional sales manager and then a zone sales manager and then state manager of this company. And with all modesty, did extremely well with it. During this time, I also started a finance company. So I was doing extremely well there. So by 1960, I decided that I should stop working so hard. And I resigned from the insurance company and was going to run the finance end of it, and found out that the staff that was there could do a much better job than I could. So I had lots of time. I should back up just a little bit and say that in 1949 I was married. And I'm sorry Hazel isn't with me, because she's most of my story, to be quite truthful, because if she hadn't reconstructed it for me, I don't know what I would tell you all tonight. And those of you who have heard me before know from where I speak. Anyway, in 1960, I had resigned from the insurance company, and with a competent staff, I did not have to fool with any of the offices I had. So I started playing golf and going to the KC Club and going to the Elks Club and visiting various establishments that had alcoholic beverages in a dry area. And nothing seemed to be of any problem. I was not having, at that time, a problem with drinking. But it was slowly, as we all know, it's so insidious, it was slowly creeping up on me. Because in 1966, I kept having pains and headaches, and I was forgetting things, and I went to a doctor at home. And he told me, he said, I can't figure out what's wrong with you. I want to send you to Memphis to a hospital where they can do all the tests. Well, a friend of mine and my wife took me to Memphis. In my briefcase, I had 2/5 of bourbon. And they checked me in, and I was shaking a little bit. And my friend, who was running the office for me, said, I think you ought to have a drink to settle you down. And the doctor was sitting there. And I opened my briefcase and had a drink. And then they started all the tests. 5 days later, the doctor came to see me and said, I am afraid that you have diabetes. And I accepted that. And he said, now I'm going to write what I think you should do, and then I want you to come back in 3 months. So he took a legal pad and he wrote it out in a scribble. And it was going to be 3 or 4 hours before my wife could get over, because it's about 180 miles, and I read it. And everything was going fine until I got down close to the bottom, and it says, no alcohol of any kind. Well, I looked at that, and that didn't suit me. So I took a pen, and I kept whittling it around, and I changed that period to a comma. And I put in his scrawl, except with water, period. Now, if I had known then what I know now, I would have known that the insanity was there. Now, my wife accepted this. We stopped and bought scales, and we bought all kinds of different food, and for 3 months, that lovely woman weighed my food and did everything like it was supposed to be, but I kept drinking. And I went back, and I don't know why, but that time I did tell the doctor I drank some, and he said, well, you still have a high blood sugar, but I think if you'd leave the alcohol off, it would probably drop. But anyway, that was my first really cunning, baffling, powerful deal with alcohol. I lied, really, without any premeditation. I just did it because I didn't want to lose my bottle. Now, that was just one thing. I was not having any apparent problems with alcohol. In 1968, on December the 15th, I was getting ready to go to an office party. And I had a briefcase in my hand. The telephone rang, and I turned around on a marble floor in the hall and reached for the telephone that was hanging in the kitchen. And a little bulldog we had ran between my legs, and I fell. And it broke my arm and shoulder. I'm put together with pins, and I'm suffering from arthritis tonight, so if you've got any sympathy, feel for me, please. There was not an orthopedic surgeon in my town, so I was taken to Nashville. It was operated on, put back together, and everything was going along fine. The third morning, I had asked Hazel to go back to Lawrenceburg to get what I thought was necessary papers and so on. And when she came back to Nashville, she found me in intensive care, strapped down in DTs. The surgeon had enough sense to call an internist, and this internist, who turned out to be a real good friend of mine in later years, was familiar with alcoholism, and he immediately knew what was wrong and started saline solutions with the necessary fluids to start bringing me down. I didn't respond, and he told my wife, and it was snowing in Nashville, it was iced in, told my wife that she had better call my family because he didn't think I would make it. I spent 3 weeks in intensive care, and it was touch and go whether I was going to make it or not, and of that time I do not remember one thing, not one. When they took me out of intensive care and put me into a regular room, I had to use a walker to help me move around. I was so weak. After quite a while, I was taken back to Lawrenceburg, and my wife got me inside and in the bed, and everything was fine. And she went back to her office to see patients. And this is what I know now made me realize I was insane later. I got up, and with my walker, I got to the bar, I opened a bottle, and got drunk. Now here, I had almost died, and the first time I have a chance to get back to alcohol, I get drunk. That is insanity. It's insanity of the worst order. Well, at this time, Hazel suggested that she thought I should stop drinking also. Now, if Hazel were here, she'd be on the front row, and she would have already stuck her hand up two or three times to make sure that I tell you that when the doctor said he's an alcoholic, that she stopped drinking immediately, but I didn't. So I said, fine, I can quit any time I want to. And she says, well, I want you to. And I found out that although I had the best of intentions and I thought I had the desire, I couldn't stop the drinking. And then I suppose what you call the fun and games started. I would wait for my wife to go to her office in the morning, and then I would get up and I would have a couple of belts before I tried to shave or bathe. I never went downtown before 10 o'clock. And by this time, my business was suffering a little also. And then Hazel started checking on various things. And I'm sure none of you have ever hidden any whiskey in the water closet, behind the books, between the mattresses. You stop buying fifths, you start buying pints, and then you buy half pints so they'll fit in your coat pocket. And this is the truth. I used to buy whiskey two cases at a time, one for her to find and one for me to drink. Now, doesn't that sound stupid today? For a man 60 years old to stand up here and say, I used to buy two cases of whiskey, one for my wife to find and pour out and one for him to drink. Hey, it's insanity. Well, this went on and on. The only thing she never did find was the Listerine bottle I kept in my bathroom in my medicine cabinet where I'd poured the Listerine out and poured the whiskey in. She never did find that one, but everything else she found. And she was rather hard on a poor drunk. In our den, I'm 6'2" tall, and we have 10-foot ceilings in our home. And on the back of the den, there's bookcases all the way to the ceiling with the television in the center of it. And I had a habit of taking my newspaper and sitting down in the den, and Hazel would be somewhere else in the house, and I'd shake the paper real loud and say, I've got to change the television program. Now, who I was talking to, I'm not aware of now. And I would go up to change the television program, even though we had a remote control back here by my chair. But there was a little secret here. My wife liked to collect pitchers, you know, the pitchers you pour out of. She had all kinds of pictures on this book cabinet up above the books. And I found one. It was a pretty blue and white picture that would hold one pint of whiskey. Just exactly one pint of whiskey. Well, for a few days, I had it made. I could have a few drinks before I went home. I could gargle real good and breeze by, you know, and get by with that, and then I could really chug-a-lug a few before I was going to eat. Well, to show you how bad some women are, one night I shook my paper. I said, I'm going to change the television set. I go up to do it. I reach up and get my pitcher, and I take a big belt and damn near died. She had found my pitcher and had put vinegar in it. You know, after almost 34 years of marriage to the same woman, I still get irritated when I think about that picture. Well, as I said, I kept telling her I would try to quit drinking, and I did try to quit drinking. I had one run-in with the law, and that was quite an episode. In the town I lived in, if I appeared to be intoxicated, the officers would take me home. And my wife didn't like that because when they brought me home, they expected to get a drink for bringing me home. But one morning I'd started to Nashville with my dog. I had a little white bulldog, beautiful little bulldog. It was my friend. And I made it almost to Nashville. There's a town about 18 miles south of Nashville called Franklin, Tennessee. And the highway patrol stopped me in Franklin, Tennessee. The city police stopped me in Franklin, Tennessee. And they were very nice to me. Now, I was telling somebody at dinner that when I was drinking, my wife dressed me, and I was a dressed-up dude. Now she says, do it yourself, and I'm not really that sharp. But I'll never forget, I had on a gray flannel suit, a white shirt, a black knit tie, my shoes were shined, I was shaved, but I wasn't driving a car very straight. So they suggested that I get in the back seat of their car, and they let me take my dog, and they recommended that one of theirs drive my car in. So they were very nice to me. They didn't put me into a drunk tank or anything, but they put me in a cell that I later found out was for women. It had a sheet on the mattress. And a couple hours later, they said, would you like to make a telephone call? And I said, yes. So I made a telephone call. I called the Commissioner of Safety of the state of Tennessee. Now, that's not as far-fetched as it sounds, because my father was in the legislature for 32 years, and believe you me, I knew the people who'd have called, but he wasn't in. So I did the next best thing. I called the captain of the highway patrol of the district I live in. Now, that was a mistake, because he was very polite to me on the telephone. I told him, I said, Captain Hamilton, they won't let me drive my car. I want you to send a patrolman up to drive me home. But he turned around and called Hazel. And Hazel got the message. There was a lady who worked in my office whose husband was a sergeant on the highway patrol. And about an hour later, I heard this, and I knew as soon as I heard these heels on this terrazzo floor that it was my wife. Because it popped with authority, you know? And I heard her say, how much? And I yelled, I've got a pocket full of money. And nothing was said to me. And I heard her say, will you please take a check? And apparently they said yes. So they came back and they opened the cell door and they said, you're free to go. And I walk out, and this patrolman standing there beside my wife is bigger than I am. And she looks at me and she says, give me my dog. And with that, she takes the dog out of my arms and turns around. Oh, she said, you wanted a patrolman, there he is. And with that, she leaves me. If you don't think that was a silent 70-mile ride back to Lawrenceburg, you're mistaken. It was real quiet. It was real quiet. I could tell you a lot of these stupid things that I did. One morning, I kept going back upstairs, and this fellow was painting our home on the inside. After I went up about the third time, his name was Joe Seifried. He's not in the program. He's now deceased. But when I came down the third or fourth time, whatever it was, Joe said, Mr. Krause, don't you think you're drinking too much? And I said, yes, Joe, I think I am. He said, I know a man, if we call, that I think can help you. And I honestly believe that my higher power that I call God was riding on my shoulder that morning, because in my opinion, I accepted the 12th step before I even knew that there was such a thing as 12 steps in Alcoholics Anonymous. He called this man and handed me the receiver, and he says, his name is Tom M. Well, he called his name, but... And I said, Mr. So-and-so, My name is Joe Krause, and I think I've got a drinking problem. And I remember Tom saying, "Where are you going to be?" And I said, "I'm going to my office." I didn't realize at that time that that man was preparing to go to court and that he'd got his case put off to come and see a drunk. But he did. He came to my office, introduced himself, and did what I think every good sponsor does. He told me his story. He did not tell me that I had a problem. He didn't tell me anything except that he had had a problem and that he had found an answer. And I believed everything he told me. Now, it wasn't that easy to stop drinking. I'll never forget, I was going to a Rotary Club meeting that Friday, and I said, "Tom, I'd like for you to go with me to the Rotary meeting." In fact, I didn't want to let him get away from me. And he said, "Joe, I don't think I ought to do that." I said, "No, I insist." Now, I'd helped every office in that club except president. And when we walked in, the 70 or so men in there, I've never seen such a rush to greet Tom in my life. I thought, my God, he knows more of them than I do. I didn't know that he was about as anonymous as I am now in a little town of 15,000 people. But there was a lot of smiles around that room. And before I go on, I'll tell you the story of that. 6 months later, I was president of that club. But Tom told me, he said, "Do you think you can do it cold turkey?" And I said, "I don't know." He said, "Well, let's go back. I'll need to meet your wife, and I want to talk to her." Now, by this time, Hazel had a little animosity towards me. Her suite of offices are on one side of this office building, and mine's on the other side. And we had to go through her receptionist and so on and so on and so on to get to her. And she came over to my office. And they sit down in my office, and they talk about it. I'll never forget, Hazel said, "Well, what'll we do with it?" You know what I'm talking about, too. Well, they talked about sending me to a place called Cumberland Heights. Now, being a real good, devout Dutchman, when they said $500, I decided that was out of the question. No, in reality, Tom said, "Why don't I take him down to my place on the river and try and let him sweat it out?" Hazel said, "I think you better take some sedatives with you." So she wrote a prescription, got it filled, gave it to Tom. I wanted them. She wouldn't give them to me. Tom said, "You can't have them." And we set off for Alabama. And that, ladies and gentlemen, and fellow alcoholics, was the longest 40 hours that followed that any of you who can remember your last drunk, and I can certainly remember this, was the worst period I have ever been through in my life. I had the cold sweats. Any of you familiar with that? I had the dry heaves. How about that? I froze to death and I burned up. I had to be wrapped up. I had to be changed, in fact. Now, that's quite a switch at 47 years of age to be changed. Everything. But Tom and his son stayed with me, and every 3 hours they would give me one of those little pills. That's how I was sponsored into AA. My wife came and got me, and Sunday morning, I had just gotten back from Mass about 8:30 in the morning. The telephone was ringing. And Hazel said, "Yes, Tom, he's here." Tom said, "Have you had a drink?" And I said, "No." He said, "Can you hold out till tonight?" And I said, "I'll do my best." And Hazel was on the other telephone. She says, "He'll hold out." Well, between my God and my one AA friend at that time, and my wife, I helped out. And we drove to Pulaski. Now, Virgil said that we lived in the same town. We don't. We live 18 miles apart. Let me tell you about these two towns. When I came into AA, May the 15th, 1970, it took four towns to make one group. Now, that's the truth. It took a town called Lawrenceburg, Pulaski, Fayetteville, and Winchester. We were named the Circuit Group. We alternated our meetings. Now, those same four towns have about 20-some-odd meetings a week, but we still go to each other's meetings. Anyway, we drive to Pulaski. My wife drives me. And we were meeting at that time in his law office. Out of five members of the firm, four of them were drunks. Four of them in the program of AA. Four of them have got years of sobriety behind them. I don't know how that fifth fellow ever stayed around them anyway. He's a Superior Court judge now. One of those attorneys, by the way, went on to become the Chief Justice of the State Supreme Court. Another one, senior trial judge. Tom was a judge, but I guess some AAs have a lot of abilities. But I saw these people out front, and I said, Hazel, I'm not going in there. She says, the hell you're not, and she pulled right in, and the people got around the car and said, Joe, we're so glad to see you. We knew you'd come someday. Why, those stinking people telling me they were going to see me? Hell, most of them owed me money anyway. That's beside the point. But anyway, they surrounded me. They took me upstairs. And I was still shaking. And I was still sweating. And there was a lady there. Her name was Sally. And she said, we're so glad to have you. But she was smart. She gave me a cup of coffee, but it was only half full. And she got my hands around it. I was still shaking. I was literally shaking all over. But she said, we love you. And we're so glad you're here. Now, that I remember. The rest of the meeting is a complete blank. I don't remember anything else about it. All I remember is that Monday morning, I woke up, and I had some hope. I had gone from just before noon on Friday until Monday morning, and I hadn't had a drink. I was still shaky. I wasn't hallucinating, but I was so unsure of myself, and I was so ashamed of myself. And if despair could have killed someone, I'd have probably been dead. But I started reading the literature that Tom had given me. And within a week, I had been to three meetings in three different towns. And the following Friday, he called and said, we need to go to Chattanooga. And I always have to tell this. I always like for Tom to be present when I tell this one, because he started me out on the long diet that is so familiar to people who have heard me talk. We left Pulaski, and it's 130 miles to Chattanooga. We got over, and he spoke at 8 o'clock. I'm starving to death. I said, Tom, I'm hungry. He reached back, got in his top coat, and gave me a Hershey bar. He said, this'll handle it. A few hours later, I said, Tom, I'm starving to death. And he wheeled into this place, and they were closing up, and he says, we'll have some scrambled eggs. Now, I've got a couple of degrees, and I'm not a dummy, but you know, I thought for over a year that you were supposed to eat scrambled eggs if you were a recovering alcoholic. I didn't know until just two or three years ago that Tom was having trouble with some dentures, and that was the only thing he was eating. That was the year that I met my friend Virgil and his wife Margaret. Because Tom had been a delegate just a short time before this, and he was elected trustee. And he tells me now that he knew I was such a batty individual that he really didn't trust me unless he had me with him. And I couldn't go anywhere unless I was with him, because Hazel wouldn't allow that. So I started going to meetings everywhere with Tom. I want to tell you all about one meeting we went to. It was in winter, and we went to a college in western Kentucky. And they had an open meeting in the gymnasium. And there was probably 1,500 or 1,600 students in the galleries around the side of the gymnasium. And they had a complete open speakers meeting. And about 11 o'clock that night, the students were still asking the people in the meeting, "I have a friend who's been having a drinking problem. Could you tell me what I should do?" And you know, I was gullible enough, I thought, gee, these kids have got lots of drinking friends. But Tom is my sponsor. He was one of three. Two of my sponsors have died. But Tom, I think, sponsored me in the way that you should be sponsored. He said, take the steps and read them. Take the big book and read it. Don't scan it, read it. I thought he was going to give me a lesson, like, you know, read the first 50 pages and write me a report on it. He didn't do it quite that way. But he says, can you accept the fact that you can't drink like a normal person? And he put things to me in such a way that I could understand that he was trying to help Joe. He said, can you say, I've admitted that I'm powerless over alcohol and that my life has become unmanageable? And in cooperation with my wife telling me the goofy things I had been doing, I could equate with that. And then I started that argument. Well, if I'm not drinking, I won't be insane. Well, if you're not insane, why do you take the first drink? I mean, he could refute everything that I said. And thank God I respected and admired him so that I believed him, and I still believe him. And he told me the truth. I've never found any of my three sponsors that didn't tell me the truth. I had one bad experience in AA. A man in Mississippi, I was on a trip down there, and he got to talking to me, and he said, you mean you've still got the same wife? And I said, yes, I have. He said, is that your car? I said, yes, it is. He said, you got a house? I said, yes, I have. He said, how much you owe on it? I said, I don't owe anything on it. He says, you ain't ready for AA. Now, it's funny, but it's tragic. Because that man didn't know my hurt. That man didn't know what was going on inside my head and my gut. That man didn't know the times I had pleaded to the God that I thought I knew, please help me. That man didn't know that people in AA had devoted time and effort to helping me attain some semblance of sobriety. I've never had any animosity towards the man, but I would like to meet him again sometime after a few years of sobriety, thank God behind me, to tell him a little bit about how bad it is to tell a person that they don't need AA, because nobody knows what somebody else needs. And I was hurting just as bad as anyone else had ever hurt. I was given many things by many people, people just like you. And I've been asked many questions about what I do. The only thing I do is read my big book and to the best of my ability follow it. I try and follow the steps in my living, and I try and follow the traditions in my service work. And I have to stay with the concepts in the service work. I read the other literature that's put out by AA. I read the 24-hour-a-day book. And I try, with the help of my God, as I understand him, and the help of all of you good people in AA, and all that I've met all over the United States and Canada, I try to find the strength to live the program and in some way try and pass it on to someone else. You know, there are many times I ask myself, am I a good AA? I don't really know. All I know is I have the desire to be of help to someone who was in the same predicament that I was in. I have the desire, I don't have the wants, I have a true desire to be a good AA. And I also ask myself, am I doing my share in AA? Now last night when I got in here from New York, I thought I was doing my share because I was beat. But today I feel real good, and I wonder if I am doing my share. I hope I am. Do I sponsor people in the proper way? I still go and ask. I go to people that I've known a long time in AA, people who have been successful in the program of AA. I ask and I sit at their feet to find out some of the answers that I have been lucky enough to get. You know, there's another thing. I have to stop and realize quite often that without AA, I'm nothing. If I hadn't have found AA and if you people hadn't have helped me, and if I hadn't found the God of my understanding, I probably wouldn't be living today. This program means so much to me that I cannot express it. It's a godsend. And I hope that I can always remember this. And I hope when I get a 12-step call, whenever it is, that I can remember that someone came to me when I called. It scares me that sometimes I feel I get a little bit smug about sobriety. But invariably, when I get that complacency, somebody calls, and I go out, and I find a drunk on their territory, and if I have to help clean them up, if I have to do all of the things that all of us probably have done at one time or another, it reinforces my sobriety. It reinforces my belief in a higher power that we're all put here on earth to do something and that we can all be of benefit to our fellow man. There's another thing. Do I thank my God for the fellowship of AA? Do I thank him for letting me have sobriety and health? I try to. I've caught myself many times, particularly on a plane or driving when I'm by myself, thinking this has happened and it's an automatic thing. Thank you, God. Thank you. Because without him, I would be nothing. I probably wouldn't be alive. I found many things that I had lost prior to coming to AA. I found self-respect. I found that I could even like Joe Krause a little bit. And before, I'd hated myself. And I certainly didn't have any self-respect. I remember I used to drive down the alleys from my home to my office to keep anybody from seeing me. Now, I love to walk down the streets of my town and say good morning or good afternoon to people. Now, the bloom is off the rose. People don't stop and say, gee, Joe, we're so proud of you now. And that kind of hurts, you know, but but I know that I have the respect of my fellow citizens. And that is so much for me. For someone who had gone down so far to be able to come back up. A lot of people say, I don't know. I believe in my God. I believe in the program of AA. I know it works. I know that if we let it, it will continue to work. You know, we find contentment and we find peace in AA if we allow ourselves to have it. We don't have to fight and argue. We can discuss, which we do so at times very heatedly. In fact, Thursday, I threatened to whip a big guy. But I love him, and we shook hands and had coffee after the meeting. I have hope that I can continue in this program. I have hope that I can be of some service to my fellow men. You know, I was told one time when I came into AA that we're all perfectionists, and I looked it up, and I studied it. And in my own particular case, I claim to be a perfectionist. But I found that it was a smokescreen for me not to do the things I didn't want to do. Because if I couldn't do it perfect, I didn't want to do it. Now, I try to do it, whatever is asked of me. Ladies and gentlemen, I am deeply grateful to have found the program of AA. I'm deeply grateful to be in Macon, Georgia tonight. You have been a wonderful audience, and I appreciate you. And I want to read you something, because I can't remember it. A lot of good things come, but memorizing just don't fit me. And I copied it out of the 24-hour day book. And when I forget to put it in my pocket when I talk, it always scares me. But it says, I shall be loyal in my attendance, generous in my giving, kind in my criticism, creative in my suggestions, loving in my attitudes. I shall give AA my interest, my enthusiasm, my devotion, and most of all, myself. Thank you for being such a good audience, and God bless every one of you.